Joshua chapter 20, beginning at verse 1. Yahweh also spoke to Joshua, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, appoint for yourselves cities of refuge, of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the slayer who kills a person accidentally or unintentionally may flee there, and they shall be your refuge from the avenger of blood. And when he flees to one of those cities and stands at the entrance of the gate of the city and declares his case in the hearing of the elders of that city, they shall take him into the city as one of them and give him a place that he may dwell among them. Then if the avenger of blood pursues him, they shall not deliver the slayer into his hand because he struck his neighbor unintentionally but did not hate him beforehand. And he shall dwell in that city until he stands before the congregation for judgment, and until the death of the one who is high priest in those days. Then the slayer may return and come to his own city and his own house, to the city from which he fled." So they appointed Kedesh in Galilee, in the mountains of Naphtali, Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim, and Kirjath Arba, which is Hebron, in the mountains of Judah. And on the other side of the Jordan, by Jericho eastward, they assigned Bezer in the wilderness on the plain from the tribe of Reuben, Ramoth in Gilead from the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan from the tribe of Manasseh. These were the cities appointed for all the children of Israel and for the stranger who dwelt among them, that whoever killed a person accidentally might flee there and not die by the hand of the avenger of blood until he stood before the congregation. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated. At the end of chapter 19, the land had been divided up and allotted to the 12 tribes. However, the process of allocation was not yet complete. There were two more things to be done, and we find those in chapters 20 and 21. Tonight, we will consider the assignment of the cities of refuge in Joshua 20, and next time we will examine the assignments of cities to the Levites in chapter 21. Now, as we've seen throughout the book of Joshua, the assignment of cities of refuge fulfills commands and promises given earlier in the Pentateuch. Reflecting on this legislation as it is carried out in Joshua helps give us a greater sense of Yahweh's justice and character. This is not just ancient history. It is a pointer to the nature of the one true God and His provision for us. We'll have a three-part outline tonight. First of all, we will consider the purpose of the cities of refuge in verses 1 through 3. Secondly, the procedures of the cities of refuge in verses 4 through 6. And finally, the placement of the cities of refuge in verses 7 through 9. The purpose, the procedures, and the placement of the cities of refuge. And we begin with their purpose in verses 1 through 3. Chapter 20 begins, "Yahweh also spoke to Joshua, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, appoint for yourselves cities of refuge, of which I spoke to you through Moses, that the slayer who kills a person accidentally or unintentionally may flee there, and they shall be your refuge from the avenger of blood." Now here the Lord tells Joshua to give commands for the assignment of cities of refuge, which he had previously spoken about through Moses. And there's several places in the books of Moses where we learn about these cities. We're going to look at several in the course of our message tonight. The first of these is found in Exodus 21. And this gives us the basic purpose for these cities. You know, Exodus 20 contains the Ten Commandments. And beginning in chapter 21, there's a series of additional laws which apply those commandments. In Exodus 21, starting at verse 12, we read, "He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. But if a man acts with premeditation against his neighbor to kill him by treachery, you shall take him from my altar that he may die." Now, this passage is the first of a series of passages in Exodus that deal with capital crimes in Israel. That is, those crimes that were punishable by death. And they are called case laws. They apply with greater specificity the general laws found in the Ten Commandments. And the first case deals with the Sixth Commandment, which says, "You shall not kill." And the basic principle and its corresponding punishment is found here in verse 12 of Exodus 21. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. Now, this builds on both the sixth commandment, which prohibits murder, and also the principle of Genesis 9, verse 6, which is a command given after the flood. Noah was told, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man." Now, there is a logic in this commandment that escapes many in our day, including, for example, the current Pope of the Roman Church. And the biblical logic runs like this. The sanctity of human life is so precious that one who violates it by murder forfeits his own life. Capital punishment for murder, when it is applied in justice, does not demean the value of human life. It actually exalts it. Now, we are often told that if we are going to be consistently pro-life, we should be opposed not only to abortion, but also to capital punishment. Now, that may sound good if human life per se is of the greatest value in the universe, but that is not the biblical teaching. Human life has value because human beings alone bear the image of our Creator. And one who destroys a fellow image bearer by murder has indirectly attacked the image granter. So precious is the life that he has taken that the only just penalty is the forfeiture of his own life. And so we get that general principle in Exodus 21:1. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. That general principle, however, needs qualification. Not every case of one person killing another is murder. So Exodus 21 goes on to distinguish between killing that is premeditated and killing that is not. The former is punishable by death. The latter requires a process to determine proper punishment. And the groundwork for that is laid in Exodus 21:13, where a provision is made for one who kills without premeditation. I will appoint for you a place where he may flee. And later situation will give a name to that place. That place will be called a city of refuge. And we read of these cities in Numbers 35. So if you have your Bible, turn over to Numbers 35. We're going to be here a few times tonight. Numbers 35, I'm just going to read a portion of its treatment of this theme in verses 9 through 12. Then Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall appoint cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee there. They shall be cities of refuge for you from the avenger, that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation in judgment." Now note that this is a commandment that was given through Moses that was looking forward to the time when they would come into the land. And now in Joshua, we are reading about that time. And there are two kinds of people that are involved in both Numbers 35 and Joshua 20. There is the manslayer who kills any person accidentally, and there is the avenger of blood. Now the word avenger... See, when you sang El Shaddai, you weren't finished your Hebrew lesson for the night. The word avenger in Hebrew is the word goel, and it means kinsman redeemer. This is one who delivers his relatives from danger and difficult situations. Now, what other book in the Old Testament do you know talks about a kinsman redeemer? Okay, the book of Ruth, right? And who was Ruth's kinsman redeemer? Boaz. And so he, in that book, was dealing with the situation where Ruth was a widow and was childless, and it was his responsibility to provide for her. Now here, we have a phrase, Goel Ha-Dam. The word dam in Hebrew means blood. And so this is what's translated, the avenger of blood. And really, it's another responsibility of a kinsman redeemer in a different situation. Again, there's something that's been done against the family, and the avenger of blood, most likely the closest male relative, was responsible to rise up and avenge the wrong that had been done. In this case, someone who had been killed. And he was authorized to kill the murderer. And this is an example of what theologians call lex talionis, Latin, the law of retaliation. And we know it by the phrase an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And what that meant was the punishment was to fit the crime. So often today, people say that is so barbaric, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And the fact is there was a lot of barbarism in the ancient Near East. This kind of law actually served to put a damper on the barbarity by not allowing the punishment to be beyond what was appropriate for the crime. You couldn't do something that was beyond that which had been done against you. And so it was actually a limiting thing that made certain that the punishment fit the crime. And so the avenger of blood could kill the murderer of his close relative. However, if the killing was accidental, which we would call manslaughter, then the killer had the right to flee to a city of refuge. And Deuteronomy 19, this is another passage we'll probably look at a few times. Deuteronomy chapter 19 gives an example of the kind of scenario envisioned in this legislation. We read in Deuteronomy 19 verses 4 and 5, and this is the case of the manslayer who flees there that he may live. Whoever kills his neighbor unintentionally, not having hated him in time past, as when a man goes to the woods with his neighbor to cut timber, and his hand swings a stroke with the axe to cut down the tree, and the axe head slips from the handle and strikes his neighbor so that he dies, he shall flee to one of these cities and live. Now, this is a case where there was no premeditation. The guy didn't go into the woods with the idea that he was going to murder his neighbor. They're actually working together to cut down trees, but the axe head accidentally flies off the axe handle, strikes the guy, and kills him. If admitted to a city of refuge, the one who had killed inadvertently was safe from the avenger of blood while he awaited judicial proceedings. This was a provision for justice in the land. This was the purpose of the cities of refuge. But let's see how this was carried out by considering the procedures for cities of refuge in verses 4 through 6. Joshua 20 proceeds to discuss such procedures, beginning in verse 4. And when he flees to one of these cities and stands at the entrance of the gate of the city and declares his case in the hearing of the elders of the city, they shall take him into the city as one of them and give him a place that he may dwell among them. Now in ancient Israel, the elders of the city were its civic and judicial council. They often met at the gates of the city. They could hold court at the gates of the city. And that is what we see in the book of Ruth. If you remember, that's where Boaz had to go to speak about the responsibility. He had to speak to the elders in the gates. And archaeologists have, you know, studied many cities in ancient Israel and have found that some of the gates actually had built-in seating right at the gates that likely was used for these kinds of purposes. Joshua 20, verse 4 describes the initial interview that the elders would conduct with one who had come claiming to have killed someone without premeditation. And it envisions the elders listening to him and deciding whether there was a prima facie case for his claim. And if so, he was admitted to the city and he was given a place to live. Verse 5, then if the avenger of blood pursues him, they shall not deliver the slayer into his hand, because he struck his neighbor unintentionally, but did not hate him beforehand. So the elders would protect the slayer from the avenger of blood based on his claim that the killing was unintentional. Another factor mentioned here, and also in Deuteronomy 19, is that the prior relationship of the two people is taken into account. If the slayer did not hate him beforehand, that was one piece of evidence in his favor. In other words, they didn't have some long-standing grudge and he took advantage of this opportunity in the woods to kill him. That didn't seem to be something that was there in their past. But if there had been a history of enmity, well, that would raise suspicion about the slayer's claim to have killed unintentionally. And I hope that what you're beginning to see is that Old Testament law, it was not so barbaric as its modern detractors often claim. Just as in a modern courtroom, mitigating factors were taken into account in the process of reaching a judgment and determining punishment. Well, verse 6 begins, "And he shall dwell in that city until he stands before the congregation for judgment." So being admitted to the city of refuge by the elders of the city was not the end of the process. The slayer was protected there until he stands before the congregation for judgment. The congregation was a reference to sometimes all the inhabitants of Israel. That's certainly not going to be the case with an individual trial. The legislation as it's given in Numbers 35 and Deuteronomy 19 suggests that the trial before the congregation takes place in the slayer's hometown, or perhaps the slain's hometown. It was likely the same. We read in Numbers 35, 24, and 25, "Then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer and the avenger of blood according to these judgments." And these judgments are the guidelines that are laid out. We didn't read all of them in Numbers 35. "So the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood, and the congregation shall return him to the city of refuge where he had fled." So there is a trial of sorts, and the avenger of blood gets to make his case, and the manslayer makes his case, and the congregation determines whether the person was innocent of intentional killing or was guilty. If he was innocent, he was sent back to the city of refuge where he could live in protection. If he was guilty, he would be handed over to the avenger of blood for execution. So not just anybody who showed up at the gate that said, "Hey, I'm innocent," was necessarily going to be spared. There was going to be a judicial trial. But there's another important element that emerges when we read Joshua 20, verse 6, in its entirety. "And he shall dwell in that city until he stands before the congregation for judgment, and until the death of the one who is high priest in those days. Then the slayer may return to his own city and his own house, to the city from which he fled." Even if the slayer was found innocent of premeditated murder, there was still penalty involved. He could not simply return to his hometown. Now, true, his life was spared, but he then had to live in the city of refuge. He was, in a sense, exiled. But his exile wasn't always permanent. He had to stay in the city of refuge until the death of the one who is high priest in those days. And once the current high priest died, he was free to return to his hometown with no fear of any retaliation against him. He could only hope that the high priest was rather elderly when he began, and I think they generally were going to be older. But that raises the question, why? Why was this the case? What did the death of the high priest have to do with the full freedom of the manslayer? And answering that question will take us to the heart of this law and its purposes in God's plan for his people Israel. Now, I suggest that there are two important and interrelated principles underlying the cities of refuge. We already addressed the first, which is the sanctity of human life. We saw how this was expressed in Genesis 9:6, "Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed." The sanctity of human life. But there's another principle involved, and that is the requirement that the land of God's people be holy. The land in which God's people dwelt had to be holy. Since God dwelt among them, they had to keep the land from becoming polluted, that is, ritually unclean. And shed blood pollutes the land. it makes it unclean before Yahweh. So if you still have your finger in Numbers 35, we can look back at Numbers 35 and read verses 32 through 34. And you shall take no ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the priest. So you shall not pollute the land where you are, for blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land, for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. Therefore do not defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, Yahweh, dwell among the children of Israel. Well, the first thing that passage tells us is it wasn't possible for the slayer to pay some kind of fine in order to be released back to his city before the death of the high priest. There was no way out of that. And the reason is that even though the slaying was accidental, blood was still shed. And as verse 33 states, no atonement can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. And so in the case of premeditated murder, the execution of the murderer rendered the land once again clean. So it could not be rendered clean except by the blood of the one who shed it, or, as we're learning, by the death of the high priest. Now, the high priest was the preeminent person in Israel involved in the atonement of God's people. He was the one who offered sacrifice, the only one who entered the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement. He is associated with the holiness that atonement restores. In Numbers 35, in verse 25, he shall remain there until the death of the high priest, who was anointed with holy oil. It's even drawing attention to the fact that he is set apart in this very special role as high priest. It appears then that the high priest, in a sense, could die in the place of the manslayer, such that the latter is then freed from his exile. Commentator David L. Stubbs notes, "The death of the high priest in this case covers or substitutes for the life taken. The high priest redeems the debt to God both by assuring that it is paid and by being the payment itself." So remember, the lex talionis, a penalty had to be paid, in this case, life for life, after the shedding of innocent blood. In the case of premeditated murder, the murderer paid with his own life. In the case of accidental slaughter, the debt was paid either by the death of the slayer in the city of refuge, if he died before the high priest did, or by the death of the high priest in his place. Only thus could the pollution of innocent blood shed be removed from the land. Now, I want to read a little bit at further length some comments from this commentary by David L. Stubbs, which I found particularly helpful on this passage, as he reflects on the legislation in Numbers 35. This is a commentary on Numbers, because what he says here is equally appropriate for what we're reading in Joshua. He writes, "These laws and provisions give two important insights into who Israel and its God are. First, they show that Israel is being trained by God to have a great respect for human life. Israel is being restrained from any presumption that lives are cheap or that people can dispose of life, their own or anyone else's, as they see fit. The practice of holy war and the many deaths caused by God throughout the book, however, show that the principle that informs this particular understanding of the sacred life is not equivalent to the modern notions of the right of a person over their own life. Life is God's, not ours. Second, the provision of the cities of refuge and the related substitution of the high priest's life for the life of an unintentional slayer show something about the content of God's justice. Just as the episode of the bronze serpent in the wilderness revealed both the sin of the people and the mercy of God, remember, they were being punished by their sin, they were being bitten by the serpents and dying, but God provided that bronze serpent that they could look upon and live. That revealed both the sin of the people and the mercy of God. The provision of the cities of refuge makes sure that the debt of the life is dealt with while at the same time providing a means for mercy for the one who is killed. Justice and mercy are intertwined in this picture of the land. Thus, we see that the procedure for the cities of refuge ensures justice and teaches vital truths about the value of human life and God's provision to deal with the shedding of innocent blood. Now, thirdly, we want to turn to look at the placement of the cities of refuge in verses 7 through 9. In the opening verses of the chapter, Yahweh had reminded Joshua of the command given through Moses for the appointment of cities of refuge. And that appointment is now made. First, in the land proper, that is the land west of the Jordan, the land of Canaan. We read in verse 7, "So they appointed Kadesh in Galilee, in the mountains of Naphtali, Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim, and Kirjath Arba, which is Hebron, in the mountains of Judah." Now, take your bulletin and look on the back, and you will find a map. This is a new map this week. And you'll see these cities. If you look up near the top, you will see Kadesh. That's mentioned first. Then if you go down, you'll find Shechem. And then go past Jerusalem, and you'll find Hebron. And these are the cities of refuge in the land west of the Jordan River, in the land of Canaan, and they're listed in order from north to south. And verse 8 then gives the appointment in the Transjordan region. We read, "And on the other side of Jordan, by Jericho eastward, they assigned Bezer in the wilderness on the plain from the tribes of Reuben, Ramoth in Gilead from the tribe of Gad, and Golan in Bashan from the tribe of Manasseh." Now again, if you look at the map, this time you'll see the cities are listed from south to north, Bezer, Ramoth, and Golan. And if you were to put your finger on Kadesh and trace through the cities in the order in which they're given, you would go down the left side, circle around, and go up the right side. And you would trace a path through the whole of the land. And that's probably why the cities are listed in order. They are shown to be distributed in such a way as to encompass all the land, both from north to south and east to west on both sides of the Jordan River. Now we should note that Moses had previously appointed these cities east of the Jordan as cities of refuge. We won't read that, but that's in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 41 through 43. Joshua, his successor, reiterates Moses on those cities, and then he adds that he has been commanded to do the cities that were west of the Jordan. Now, children, and you count too, Lydia, not just our catechism children, I have a question for you. You've got to put your thinking caps on for this. Now, remember the purpose of these cities of refuge. These were places where someone could flee for protection if they had accidentally killed someone. And on the map, you'll see that they're spread all throughout, rather evenly distributed throughout the land of Israel. Now, why do you think that it was important for them to be spread out in this way rather than having all of them close to one another? Can you think of why that would be important given their purpose? I'm going to open this up to the adults because I'm not getting an answer. Rod? Right. Each of those cities could be reached by one day's travel, no matter where you lived in Israel. And if you were the one who had accidentally killed someone, it was important for you to be able to get to the city of refuge as soon as possible. Because if the Avenger of Blood got to you before you got there, he had the right to execute you on the spot. And so it was a provision of mercy to have them located this way. The distribution of the cities even determines some of Israel's infrastructure. We've heard about infrastructure in the news lately. It's something that Congress and the President has hung up about. Referring to the land west of the Jordan, we read in Deuteronomy 19:3, "You shall prepare roads for yourself and divide into three parts the territory of your land in which Yahweh your God is giving you to inherit, that any manslayer may flee there." Now, that's referring in context to the land west of the Jordan. But the placement of cities and the construction of the roads ensured the accessibility of justice to all in Israel. Again, we're not just talking about some barbaric ancient legal code. There's a concern for the proper procedures of justice and even the accessibility of justice to anyone in Israel. Joshua 20 concludes with a summary statement in verse 9. These were the cities appointed for all the children of Israel and for the stranger who dwelt among them, that whoever killed a person accidentally might flee there and not die by the hand of the avenger of blood until he stood before the congregation. Now, there's one more thing that's added here in the summary statement, and that was that the procedures were for strangers dwelling within Israel as well as for the Israelites themselves. These strangers were resident aliens, people who had permanently left their homeland to live within Israel. In various places, the law specifically applied to them and showed their inclusion in national life. We see this, for example, in Passover commandments in Exodus 12, verses 48 and 49. And when a stranger dwells with you and wants to keep Passover to Yahweh, let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near and keep it. And he shall be as a native of the land, for no uncircumcised person shall eat it. One law shall be for the native born and for the stranger who dwells among you. And you see, there's a standard of equality there, not only for those who are ethnically of Israel, but even the resident aliens among them had equal treatment under the law. It's one of the many signs also in the Old Testament of the wideness of God's mercy extended not only to Israel, but also to those from other nations. We don't live in ancient Israel. Don't know if you noticed that. And if you look on a map of Tennessee, you won't see any cities noted as cities of refuge. But there are still important lessons for us in Joshua 20. We've noted a few. One thing is that this chapter points to the sanctity of human life, which is an issue of great debate right now in our nation. As voters and state legislatures continue to pass laws expanding protection of the lives of the unborn, Hollywood actors and liberal judges continue to cry out against such protection. The blood of many judicially innocent unborn babies has been shed in our land. And we should do things. First of all, we should pray, vote, and support efforts to change our laws to protect unborn life. Secondly, we should minister with compassion to pregnant women in difficult circumstances and to those who have aborted their babies. And thirdly, we should address issues of poverty and inequity that make abortion seem like the only way out for many women whose lives are far different in their circumstances than our own. These women and their unborn babies are both image bearers of their Creator. A society that neglects them is surely in a death spiral. This chapter has also demonstrated the linking of justice and mercy in God's law. Speaking of Israel under the Old Covenant, our Confession of Faith, the Westminster Confession of Faith, declares, "To them also, as a body politic, God gave sundry judicial laws which expired together with the state of that people, not obliging any other now further than the general equity thereof may require." Now that's a good 17th century English sentence, which we sort of have to parse sometimes. What it means is that God's civil laws for ancient Israel are not to be simply imported and become, as they stand, the civil laws of the United States today. We don't believe that's the proper way to interpret the civic legislation under the Old Covenant. For instance, we don't need to establish cities of refuge and specific procedures related to those cities that we've learned about tonight. However, we are required to consider the general equity of such laws. And the general equity are the transcultural and the transhistorical principles that underlie them. There are principles of right and justice to be found in these laws. And when we can understand those principles, then we say, okay, how do we then apply that in our day, in our land? After all, even the civil law of Israel was rooted in the unchanging nature and character of God, and we have much to learn from it. For instance, we need to recognize the difference between murder and manslaughter in our legal system and to have different penalties for each. we need to do our best to see that true justice is equally accessible to all and not just to the privileged and the wealthy. There is much for us to learn and apply from God's law, and the general neglect of it by contemporary Christians is a sign of spiritual decline. Finally, and most importantly, the provisions of the city of refuge point forward to Jesus Christ. We see this particularly in the fact that atonement had to be made for wrong, and it was possible for that atonement to be made through the death of the high priest. And this anticipates the work of our high priest, Jesus. As you know, this is one of the key themes of the book of Hebrews. There are a number of passages we could look at. Let me just read Hebrews chapter 7, verses 26 through 28. For such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and has become higher than the heavens, who does not need daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints as high priests men who have weakness, but the word of oath which came after the law appoints the Son who has been perfected forever. And with that in mind, I'd like to close by reading one more paragraph from the commentary by Stubbs. He writes, "This combination of justice and mercy in the structure of Israel's life in the land reveals something of the heart of God. The way the righteousness of God is combined with his mercy is most fully revealed in Jesus Christ, the great high priest. Early Christian commentators often understood these particular provisions to provide shadows of Jesus, the great high priest. Paterius puts it this way, what does it mean that a homicide returns for absolution after the death of a high priest, except that the human race, which brought death upon itself by sinning, receives absolution for its guilt after the death of the true priest, namely our Redeemer? In Jesus Christ, God is acting as kinsman redeemer and high priest on our behalf. This same zeal for justice intertwined with mercy should also characterize the life of the people of God. So may we learn from God's law and live for our Savior."